From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Capital Punishment and Alberto Gonzalez. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Responding to a nationwide backlog on death row, Congress passed a law that could speed up the pace of executions. It transfers certain powers from federal judges to the Attorney General of the United States. That's focused new attention on Alberto Gonzalez. On To the Point, what's his record on capital punishment cases in Washington and previously in Texas? Death penalty advocates say he's the right man to handle issues of life and death. Others raise questions about the potential for executing the wrong people when the process moves too fast. On Reporter's Notebook later on, the verdict is in on Jose Padilla. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warren Alney, back with To the Point. Juries are handing out death sentences faster than states can conduct executions. Congress has given the U.S. Attorney General new powers to speed up the process. On To the Point, is Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez the right man for the job? We'll look at his record and hear about fears that too much haste could lead to fatal mistakes. On Reporter's Notebook, the verdict is in on Jose Padilla. We will get the background on that. First, then, is the news update. The stock markets tumbled again today in Asia, Europe, and the United States, where the three leading indicators are down 10% from all-time highs posted last month. The question is, will the impact send the economy into recession? Vikas Bajaj is a business reporter for the New York Times. Good to have you with us.
Good to be here.
How far down are the indicators? The market hasn't quite closed as yet.
No, we've got another couple of hours to go, Warren. The indicators are climbing back. They were down almost 2.5% at one point, and now we're back down below 1% in the 1% range.
Nonetheless, there has been a tremendous fall since just last month. Are we technically seeing a correction?
Yeah, technically we are. We're at the point where technicians like to say that anytime the market falls from its high of the moment, of the period, by 10% or more, we have had a correction. If it falls more than 20%, we're in a bear market. Those are just sort of signposts that don't really tell us that much, but sort of way of marking the dial, if you will.
The Federal Reserve pumped some money into the markets. What's the impact of that likely to be?
It's likely to, they've been doing this for some days now. It's provides some stability to the market, but it's certainly not enough to reassure investors that, you know, all is well with the world.
All this, of course, has to do with the housing market, or at least that's where it started. You're reporting today in the New York Times that Countrywide Financial, the largest mortgage lender of all, mm-hmm. has had to take out $16 billion in emergency loans. That sounds like big money.
11.5, actually. But yes, it is big money. And what's more significant about it is the fact that it's their sort of last line of defense. It's the money that they have as a backup if all else fails. And so the fact that they're drawing on that piece of their financing is critical. It means that they're not able to borrow in the short-term market, or at least borrow at the, you know, at a reasonable rate. That they have to take such a drastic action. This comes a day after an analyst from Merrill Lynch speculated that the company may have to file bankruptcy if there's a run on the bank, if you will.
What would bankruptcy mean for the largest mortgage lender in the country?
Well, it would be a huge hit to the confidence in the economy. It would mean thousands and thousands of jobs would be eliminated. Certainly in places like Los Angeles and Southern California, would be a huge hit.
But these would be jobs in the construction industry?
No, certainly in the construction industry, we've already seen a lot of that. But this would be jobs in mortgage lending and mortgage brokering, real estate sales. It would be sort of a much broader segment of the economy than just the building of new homes, which is an important part of the economy, but relatively small compared to the broad housing economy, if you will.
So what would it mean then if people wanted to buy or sell their houses?
It certainly makes it a lot harder to get credit. If you want a certain kind of loan today, one that's, for instance, more than $417,000 in LA and New York, it's pretty easy to go above 417 in a blink of an eye. It's going to be harder for you to get that loan. You're going to have to put down more money, and you're probably going to pay a big higher interest rate.
Of course, the word recession immediately springs to mind. What about that?
The economy so far, from the readings that we have as of July, is not in recession, and that's something that certainly a lot more people are talking about today than were just a month ago. It has the possibility, as you say, of a knock-on effect. If people can't buy houses, they can't refinance, that's going to really slow down consumer spending, and that's really where it would come from is slow down consumer spending. People lose their jobs and can't meet their mortgage payments. That's going to have a big impact.
Of course, the real impact of this takes place over a long term. But what should people be looking at tomorrow and starting next week to get a sense of how bad things really are?
Well, I think the stock market is going to be where a lot of people are going to be looking because it is sort of the broadest gauge that we have. But in addition to that, I think people need to be looking at what's happening in the bond markets, which is where the action really is these days. That's where, everybody from governments to corporations and even homeowners essentially borrow money. And if those markets continue to be seized up as they have been, it's not going to be a good sign. If there's some light, it would be in the sense of more deals being done, more debt being sold and placed and traded. Right now, that's just not happening.
All right. Well, I won't ask you for any predictions. You probably wouldn't give them to me anyway.
I can't give you any predictions.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot for being with us. Vikas Bajaj, again, a business reporter for The New York Times. In a moment, Capital Punishment and Alberto Gonzalez on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, and I'll be back with To The Point. There are 3,300 convicts on death row in the United States, more than 600 in California alone. Just 53 people were executed last year. Lengthy appeals and moratoriums in some states have delayed the process of capital punishment. When Congress reauthorized the Patriot Act, it included a provision that could speed things up by transferring certain authority from federal judges to the Attorney General of the United States. That's extended debate about the death penalty to the record of the current Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez. Richard Smith covers the Justice Department for the Los Angeles Times. Richard, good to have you on our program.
Good to be with you, Warren.
Congress has been trying to speed up this process since 1996. Is that right?
It goes back. This is a long debate. It goes back more than a decade. It all started with a federal law in 1996 that envisioned a system where the federal government would agree to speed up the federal appeals process in death penalty cases if the feds could be assured that the defendants in those cases were getting competent counsel at the state level. And it was one of the primary sort of the building blocks of that legislation, and it was passed and signed into law by President Bill Clinton. And subsequently, a number of states applied to federal judges in the hope of getting this so-called fast-track authority, and federal judges who received those petitions basically said, no dice, we don't think the systems you have in place ensure adequate and competent counsel. And since then, we've been kind of at a stalemate, And a couple of years ago, there were efforts in Congress led by some lawmakers in the West, whose states had a large number of folks on death row, who were seeking to, streamline or speed up these procedures once again, and hearings were held. Ultimately, it led to this provision in the otherwise terror-fighting Patriot Act reauthorization bill. Last year, in which the authority to approve these state petitions was transferred from federal judges to the Attorney General. And that was the primary move that was made. And subsequently, that was passed, and the Justice Department was given this new authority, and they're now in the process of promulgating sort of the ground rules on how that's going to work, what the standards are going to be, and what are the procedures that states have to follow in order to apply to the Justice Department and the Attorney General to get these new authority. And the Justice Department is currently taking public comment, and once they are done receiving that sometime next month, or they may have extended that actually sometime in September, early October, they plan to promulgate final rules, and then it's off to the races, presumably races to the courts again, where I think these issues are likely to be hashed out in hard-fought litigation between those who view the landscape in a way that if you're going to have the death penalty, there's no need to be having 10, 20, 25-year delays and conducting executions, and those who believe that state systems for providing counsel are woefully inadequate.
When they put it into the Patriot Act, as you indicated, that was an anti-terrorist bill. Not a lot of people likely to vote against that in Congress. Was there any debate or much debate publicly about this provision?
You know, you recall that there was that bill itself was necessitated by the fact that the original Patriot Act passed a few weeks after 9/11 had provisions in it that sunsetted after 5 years. So Congress had to take certain action in order for the Patriot Act to remain in effect. There was debate over that in Congress, and it was debated and postponed, and I think over the Christmas holiday a year ago. And there was a lot of back and forth and political finger pointing between the White House and the Congress at that point over taking action. And finally, this bill, there was a meeting of the minds, and the bill was passed in March of 06. There were, it was not the lead agenda item by any stretch of the imagination. And this reauthorization bill is sort of well known for other aspects that have nothing to do with terror fighting either. I mean, one provision, for example, your listeners will probably know maybe a little bit about this whole flap over the firing of U.S. attorneys last year, and it was in this Patriot Act bill, the reauthorization bill, that there was also a provision that allowed the Justice Department to use interim authority to appoint U.S. attorneys without going through the Senate confirmation process. That measure, once lawmakers reflected upon it earlier this year, was repealed in the belief that it
okay.
basically helped facilitate the whole firing of the U.S. attorneys as well.
Back to the question of the day, if in fact the Attorney General does accept a state's application to speed up the process by certifying that they do in fact provide adequate defense counsel for people in death penalty cases, that shortens then the appeals process?
Well, first of all, the Attorney General decides. I believe there's a provision in there that says his decision is appealable to the Federal Appeals Court in Washington, D.C., the thinking being that since the circuit here does not get involved in hearing a lot of death penalty-related matters, it would be more or less be able to make a neutral judgment in that regard. But to answer your question, If a state is allowed to adopt these fast track procedures, then once the state's appellate process is exhausted, then the time that the lawyers for the defendant would have to file a federal habeas corpus petition would be, I think, cut in half from from a year to 180 days. That's one of the changes. Some other changes relate to deadlines that are placed on federal judges so far as when they have to issue decisions weighing in on those appeals.
Okay. So once again, the point was to shift the responsibility for making these decisions from federal judges, who a lot of people in Congress thought were taking too long, to the Attorney General, who might be more likely to certify that states do in fact have adequate counsel for the defense in capital punishment cases. Richard Smith, again, reporter for the Los Angeles Office Times covers the Justice Department. This, of course, then brings up the question of Alberto Gonzalez and his record in this regard. Paul Charlton spent 16 years as a prosecutor in Arizona. He then became U.S. attorney when President Bush named John Ashcroft as attorney general. Later, Mr. Charlton was fired by Alberto Gonzalez. In testimony before the U.S. Senate, Charlton talked about the case of Rios Rico, who faced murder charges in a case where there was no gun, no ballistics evidence, no victim's DNA on the defendant, and no body. Mr. Charlton, welcome to our program.
Thank you for having me.
You recommended to the department, or you told the department, that you didn't intend to file death penalty, to ask for the death penalty in this case for the reasons I just laid out, because of the lack of evidence and even a body. What was the response?
Well, the attorney general asked that we seek death in that case, and I appealed to his office, to the chief of the criminal division, and to the deputy attorney general, asking them to reconsider that decision, because I think it's important to look at the quality of evidence before you seek to take another person's life. And because while it is tragic to be wrong in any prosecution, it is inexcusable to be wrong when you're seeking to take another person's life. And so the certitude that I felt was necessary to go forward with a death penalty case in good conscience was absent here.
You asked that the body involved, everybody knew where it was, it's buried. You asked that it be exhumed so that it could at least be examined for the purposes of gathering evidence. So what was the decision about that?
Well, that was certainly a part of my thought process here, that if we had the body, we could either have evidence that would allow you in good conscience to proceed with the case, because the body would show evidence to support your contention that this was in fact a death penalty case, or perhaps the body would show evidence inconsistent with the theory of your case and weaken the case. When I asked for monies sufficient to exhume the body, we were denied that request, and again, that was one of the pillars of the argument that I made to try to convince the Attorney General not to go forward with this death penalty decision.
How long, how much time, how much attention do you think the Attorney General and his deputies gave to your request that they reconsider their asking you to ask for the death penalty?
Well, after speaking to the number two person in justice, Paul McNulty, and asking that he speak to the Attorney General on this issue, I received a report back indicating that Paul McNulty had spent, quote, a significant amount of time on this issue with the Attorney General, perhaps as much as 5 to 10 minutes. And that was, of course, disconcerting.
Disconcerting. Again, Paul Charlton is former U.S. attorney in the state of Arizona. William Rusty Hubberth is vice president of Justice for All. That's a victims' rights group. He's former general counsel of the Board of Pardons and Paroles Division of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice. Mr. Hubberth, welcome to you.
Thank you for having me also.
Are you disconcerted by what Paul Charlton just told us about the amount of time given, the amount of attention given, and the quality of the decision made by the Justice Department?
Well, only to the extent that it'd be case-specific, first of all. It's not a standard policy. Second of all, it would almost sound like if an exhumation would have exonerating evidence, then it would be the burden of the defense to bring it, not the prosecutor, who should be following the orders of his superiors, being as he is a branch of the government. Therefore, I'm sorry that Mr. Charlton was disconcerted about the process that he encountered on that specific case. I don't know if Mr. Charlton had ever prosecuted a death case before that or had sought the death penalty in any other case, and I think that needs to be developed too, because it may be a philosophical difference as opposed to a procedural
one. Let's ask him. Paul Charlton, what about it?
When I was a U.S. attorney, we sought the death penalty. I've prosecuted a number of homicide cases. I was a career prosecutor until January of this year.
And when you were prosecutor for the state, did you ask for the death penalty?
Never as the state. I was a federal prosecutor for 16 years. So as the U.S. attorney, we sought the death penalty. And so that's not the issue as far as I can tell. The issue is when it's appropriate to seek the death penalty and who it is that's making that decision.
So here, Mr. Hubberth, then, is a man who supports the death penalty, as do you, but is disconcerted because of the time and attention given. 5 to 10 minutes called a significant amount of time. Is that a significant amount of time?
Case specific, again. it's case specific. One would say no, but if it was a complete determination issue, I don't think that that's going to stand up at any appellate level if it was determinative. However, again, I think this would be a burden for the defense to bring forward as opposed to the state.
And when you say it's case specific, what you mean is it doesn't say anything about the broader policies of the department because it's only one case.
Sir, I have to look at this in the context of a disgruntled former employee, too. And so I'm not familiar with federal policies or in-house policies with the Attorney General's office. I've never been hired by them. I have two very good friends, Johnny Sutton and Robert Cadena, that are involved with the criminal justice policies, or with the AG's office. But I have never been a U.S. attorney, so I don't know about the in-house policies. And again, this may be case-specific. If this had happened every time you had asked about a death prosecution, then yeah, that would be indicative of a policy argument. But this isn't indicative of a policy argument. It's indicative of a certain case.
Paul Charlton, I said earlier you were hired by John Ashcroft. You weren't. You were 16 years in a U.S. attorney in Arizona. But what about the differences between Ashcroft and Gonzalez as far as policies in this area are concerned?
With John Ashcroft, I was given the opportunity to speak with him about the death penalty, particularly and personally. With Alberto Gonzalez, that wasn't the case. And I would add that in this country and under our Constitution, the defense has no burden in criminal cases. I don't know what Mr. Hubbard's background is, but the Constitution provides that it's the government that has the burden of proof in all things relating to criminal prosecutions.
Okay. Let's take a look at what happened before the president and the current attorney general got to Washington. Alberto Gonzalez advised Governor George Bush on clemency for death penalty convicts. In 6 years, 150 men and women were executed, each time Gonzalez provided Bush with a document summarizing the facts of the case, the defendant's personal background, and a legal history as well. Those documents were made public in 2003, and the Atlantic magazine published a lengthy story about them. The author was Alan Berlow, who joins us now. He's overseas, but joins us for our program. And Alan Berlow, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
What did you find about the quality of the judgments, I guess is what we're really talking about here, having to do with clemency for death penalty cases in Texas?
What I found, and just to your point on the 152 executions that Bush presided over, only 57 of the clemency documents were done under Gonzalez. After those 57, he retired and went on to another office.
Okay.
So looking at those 57 clemency memos, what I found was that in virtually every case, Gonzalez overlooked evidence of sometimes of innocence, evidence of incompetent counsel, evidence that had not been presented to juries, mitigating evidence. Gonzalez wrote these summaries of executions that were presented to Bush typically on the morning of the execution. So to this point of Mr. Charlton's earlier of getting 10 to 15 minutes, what Gonzalez and Bush had in each of these cases was a 15 to 30-minute briefing on these executions.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to hold that thought. We're going to come back, continue this conversation with Alan Berlow and our other guests. On Reporter's Notebook a little bit later, we'll hear about Jose Padilla, the U.S. citizen, first accused of a dirty bomb plot, then tried for association with al-Qaeda. He has been found guilty. We'll hear about that. More in a moment on To the Point.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. We're talking today about a new law that gives the attorney general rather than federal judges the opportunity to fast-track executions in states where executions have been held up by very lengthy appeals and by moratoriums in some cases as well. We're talking now about the current attorney general, Alberto Gonzalez, and his role in death penalty cases. Alan Berlow is a freelance journalist. He's written in the Atlantic Monthly about the 57 clemency cases out of 150 executions in Texas that Mr. Gonzalez advised then-Governor George Bush about. And you said to Alan Berlow earlier that they were presented these summaries on the morning of the execution. That suggests to you that not enough time was given to the considerations involved.
Well, what happened was that if you present them on the morning of the execution and you have a 15 to 30 minute discussion about it, what if the governor were to raise a question about, well, this guy didn't seem to have adequate counsel, or that guy, evidence that he was mentally retarded, as was the case in several of these cases, was not presented to the jury. He could theoretically say to Mr. Gonzalez at that time, well, why don't you go out and research this, and let's delay the execution for 30 minutes. There's no evidence that that ever happened. If anyone presents a sort of paradigm for why you don't want to give the Attorney General this authority, it would be Alberto Gonzalez. What you're dealing with, or we're dealing with in these 57 cases, was a matter of life and death. Now, obviously, we know that George Bush and Alberto Gonzalez were interested from the moment Bush took office in expediting executions, and that's what this speed up is all about. The underlying assumption is that if you speed up these executions, it's good for deterrence, that the death penalty is a deterrent, and the more you have of these executions, the more you will have a deterrent effect. What Gonzalez and Bush did was they set up a system which basically said, let's figure out how we cannot have any clemency. And what Bush said was, okay, well, we'll give clemency in only two situations. One, if the person is innocent, and two, if the person has not had full access to the courts. Well, by full access to the courts, Bush simply meant, well, the case had been reviewed. It had gone through the judicial system. No clemency case arrived on the governor's desk without having gone through the courts. So that was a charade. The second possibility, absolute evidence of innocence, only arose in one case where a guy by the name of Henry Lee Lucas, a serial killer, evidence was presented to the governor that Lucas could not have committed the particular murder for which the state of Texas was about to execute him for. What Gonzalez and Bush did was systematically undermine a clemency process, a review process. This is not the guy who you want to be giving the authority to speed up executions to.
When you say that the mental retardation was a factor not presented to the jury, how many times did that happen?
You know, Warren, I don't recall exactly the number of cases. There was, as you know, as your listeners probably know, executing the mentally retarded is now unconstitutional. The Supreme Court decided that a few years ago. At the time, it was legal, but there happened to be a very explosive case that was wending its way through the courts. It had been up and down in front of the Supreme Court several times. The guy's name was John Paul Penry, and the Supreme Court had, on several occasions, sent it back to the Texas courts for review because Penry was a guy of who was either retarded or mentally ill, and the court was trying to decide that issue at the time. So you had this very explosive case before the courts. Gonzalez was perfectly aware of it, and nevertheless, he approved the execution of a guy by the name of Terry Washington, who was severely mentally retarded. He'd been a victim of childhood sexual abuse. He'd been beaten by his father with a fan belt from a car. Horrifying case. And nevertheless, Bush approved that execution. Perfectly legal at the time, but the fact of his mental retardation was never presented to the governor in that clemency in the clemency review prepared by Gonzalez. Now, it should also be said that Gonzalez never presented the governor with a full clemency petition, which would have presented the full details, at least from the defense point of view, of why that person should have been spared from the death penalty.
Alan Berlow, a journalist, has written for The Atlantic Monthly, among other publications. Let me go back to William Rusty Hubbard. Again, this is something that you're intimately familiar with, or a process, at least, that you are, because you were general counsel of the Board of Pardons and Paroles Division.
Actually, the Pardons and Paroles Division, but I worked with the Board of Pardons and Paroles. I prepared.
Were you there during the Bush years?
Just for several months. Before that, I was with Ann Richards' office.
Okay. The former governor of Texas.
The former governor of Texas. And I prepared the summaries, as Mr. Gonzalez did to President Bush, or to Governor Bush. I prepared them for the Board of Pardons and Paroles.
Okay.
One of the ones I did was the first round of Gary Graham. There were several others, quite a few others, actually, that I prepared. What Mr. Berline is, excuse me, the previous speaker.
Mr. Berlow, Alan Berlow.
Mr. Berlow neglected to inform you was the clemency, one, is not a constitutional right. The consideration for clemency can be, but the right to get clemency, there is no right there. Two, in Texas, the governor does not control. The clemency is voted upon by, at the time, it was an 18-member board of appointed people by the Pardons and Paroles Division. And because their vote controls, the governor in Texas only has the power to grant one 30-day reprieve. This was done by Governor Richards in two cases due to political pressure, one from the Vatican, one from some of the citizens of Texas. But they do not have the power to grant or delay, just ad hoc and out of hand, an execution or to grant clemency of any sort. And clemency, again, is not a right. You do not have the right to clemency. Rather than retry each of these cases, obviously, Governor Bush decided that that's what the court's job was. And that if the court, including the United States Supreme Court, it wasn't in Texas that makes the final determination of this. It's in Washington, and there are no Texans currently serving on the United States Supreme Court. They're the ones that make the ultimate decision. So if there was a problem in any way, shape, or form with the trial, other than manufactured sentimental arguments, which we saw a great number of, then it should rest with the Supreme Court. But when they turn their thumb down on this, it is not the governor's job to have someone demand that he grant clemency. It's the Bar of Pardons and Paroles in Texas, not the governor.
So the governor can only delay for 30 days. That's the only thing he could do?
Once.
One time. So, Alan Berlow, that puts a different light on this, does it not?
No, it really doesn't. What Mr. Hubbard hasn't told you is that while the law in Texas says that the governor may only grant a 30-day reprieve, Governor Bush appointed, by the time he left office as governor, he had appointed all 18 members of the Board of Pardons and Paroles. Governor Bush could have asked the BPP to delay an execution. He could have asked them to conduct an investigation. He could have asked them to do any number of things that would have reinvestigated had he had a question about innocence, about mitigating evidence, about any of the kinds of issues that come up in clemency. It's true that the governor isn't obligated to grant clemency. Clemency is an extrajudicial process. It's a prerogative. But what you're dealing with here is a matter of life and death, and Governor Bush established the standard, Mr. Hubbard. This isn't some sort of, legal standard. Governor Bush said, if there's a question of innocence, I want to know about it. If there is mitigating evidence, if there's evidence that a jury didn't hear, I want to know about it. He established this standard, but it was a thoroughly bogus standard.
Okay, William Hubbard, back to you on that issue.
To me, it sounds like an excellent standard. Let's trust what the juries are doing. Let's trust what the appellate courts are doing. Let's trust what due process is doing. Other than that, he's deferring to the people he appointed because he usually did a very good job in picking his appointees. And might I add, sir, that there wasn't much use of the clemency process previous to Governor Bush. So it's not Governor Bush, who I think has done President Bush now, who had did a much more sincere job of studying these cases than his predecessor did. His predecessor would grant reprieves solely for political purpose. Governor Bush doesn't do that.
Okay. Again, William Hubbard was general counsel of the Division of Pardons and Paroles of the Texas Department of Criminal Justice when Ann Richards was governor, and then for a few months under President Bush. Then Governor George Bush. Let me raise another question. Mr. Hubbard said that, and Alan Berlow said as well, that these were issues for the courts to decide. What we're talking about today is a change in federal law which shifts the responsibility for the fast tracking of executions from federal judges to the Attorney General of the United States, whomever that might be, whether it's Mr. Gonzalez or anybody else. Steve Bright is senior counsel consult the Southern Center for Human Rights. That's a public interest legal project, provides representation to people who face the death penalty. And Steve Bright, thank you very much for being with us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
What about the broader question of whether the kinds of decisions that we are talking about should be made by judges or by the Attorney General?
Well, it's important to look at exactly what this is about, which is going from a system where judges treat cases individually based on how complicated they are, what the evidence is, what's needed to pull the evidence together, have a hearing, whether it's a very serious, complex case or one that's not as much, whether you're going to put those on a strict time limit where judges have, first of all, they've got to be filed within 6 months. We already have a number of cases in Texas where people have missed the one-year deadline for filing, so those people didn't get any review at all because their lawyers didn't file within the statute of limitations or the deadline. Now that's going to be shorter, 6 months. And then everything is on a very tight time frame. It's sort of like a small claims court case where the cases are dealt with very expeditiously. It's a bad idea to begin with. And that's why no federal court in all these years since the statute was enacted in 1994 has approved this system. So what has happened was to slip this in the Patriot Act and switch from having federal judges decide it to having the Attorney General of the United States decide it, who, as has been pointed out here, is the prosecutor of capital cases in the federal system. It was really a conflict of interest. But I think what the point was made before, and the one we should all take seriously, regardless of how we look at this issue, whether we're for capital punishment or against it, is that often these cases are treated very casually. They're not, the lawyers are not very good. They're taken through the system very expeditiously. When the point was made earlier about the defense should pay for the exhumation, virtually all of the people are poor. Most of them can't afford a lawyer, can't afford an expert. Most of them can't afford a telephone call. So the likelihood that the defense is going to pay is virtually non-existent, which puts a greater burden, of course, on the prosecutor, who, if he or she is being responsible, wants to make sure that this is a case that really the evidence is there, the degree of certitude is there, that this can be brought as a death penalty case.
All right. Back to Rusty Hubberth, in Texas on two issues. First, the strict time requirement, turning this into a sort of a small claims procedure, according to Mr. Bright. And secondly, the question of whether the Attorney General essentially has a conflict of interest.
Well, in regards to the time limits, if they put them in there, they're imposed. They're specific. It sets the guidelines. People have to act within the guidelines. If there's a set time limit, get your paperwork done. Get it in on time.
But in cases of life or death?
In cases of any cases, again, if from small claims forward, the rules are there. The guidelines are there. This is how it is done. And if it requires extra effort, then that life and death argument should be considered at that point in time in order to get the extra effort out. But get it done on time. That's
but,
all.
But if you have poor defendants who can't afford to make phone calls and they don't manage to, don't have adequate counsel and the deadline expires and they're therefore not able to challenge their cases, is that justice?
That would seem like almost a secondary habeas action. But in regards to that, okay, one, every state in the country, especially in Texas, is changing the requirements for capital defense attorneys. There's money out there these days. There are capital defense attorneys that are being trained, selected, and screened. We had one notorious case in Texas where one of the older defense counsel nodded off during a witness's testimony and has become infamous as the sleeping lawyer. Well, that is not the norm, and I don't think anyone on this conversation will agree that it is.
Well, what about the issue of conflict of interest for the chief prosecutor of the United States to be making these kinds of decisions?
Apples and oranges, because it's a procedural aspect on state law. And yes, as a Texan, I'm going to talk about state sovereignty in regards to their laws. And all he's doing is talking about the process and the guidelines, not about the facts, not about capital punishment or the state procedures for capital punishment. All he's talking about are the federal habeas guidelines. And for that matter, I think it's a good thing.
Steve Bright, as quickly as possible, your response on both of these questions. The fact that we simply have to have rules, and of course there have been enormous delays. Is that appropriate in states where a capital punishment is legal? And second, the question of who makes the decision.
Well, there are two points here. One, somebody files a civil suit that's just simply about money. Those cases have no time, nor do any other cases have this sort of that the district court has to decide the case in 450 days. I mean, we don't apply that to virtually any other kind of case in the legal system. I just want to add one thing with regard to the sleeping lawyers, because I've paid a little attention to that. There actually were three in Houston alone defense lawyers who slept during their capital trial that they were defending, and there are two pretty notorious lawyers there who put 27 people on death row. That's actually larger than the death row of many states in the country. One had 10, one had 17. So that's the quality of justice that often is being reviewed by the federal judges. And they're often finding that the Constitution of the United States is being violated in these trials. And all of us should be concerned about that. And if it hasn't been done right, then particularly where life and liberty is at stake, we need to go back and do it right.
Okay, Mr. Hubbard, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we're out of time. Mr. Hubbard, very quickly, what about the quality of justice, generally speaking, with regard to the death penalty in this country?
Again, it's being reviewed by the United States Supreme Court. In regards to life and death, let's take 1 second and remember the life and death of the victims as to why those people are on death row in the first place. In regards to the justice, there is nothing that is examined more minutely than a capital case. And in order to put a person to death, to bring it to the sentence that's been pronounced by the jury, then it undergoes finite examination. And I have no problem. Again, okay. I throw down the gauntlet, show an innocent person being executed in Texas, the most prolific death penalty case in the country, and I might readjust my views.
Okay.
I think we do it right.
We'll have to wait for another program on that. In the meantime, obviously, some of your comments are controversial with our other guests. We'll follow this, see if the Congress does address it again between now and the time that the Justice Department comes out with its rules, or perhaps after that at some point. William Rusty Hubberth, formerly General Counsel of the Division of Pardons and Paroles at the Department of Criminal Justice in Texas. Steve Bright with the Southern Center for Human Rights. Alan Burlow with the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Paul Charlton, former U.S. Attorney for Arizona, and our earlier guest, Richard Schmidt, reporter for the Los Angeles Times. Jurors reached a verdict today in the trial of Jose Padilla, who was charged along with two co-defendants with supporting al-Qaeda and other violent Islamic extremist groups overseas. All were found guilty. We'll have more on that in a moment on To the Point.
For more information about To the Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/to the point.
Mormon Olney back with Paul Waters' notebook on To the Point. American citizen Jose Padilla originally was accused of being part of an al-Qaeda plot to detonate a radioactive dirty bomb in the United States. He was interrogated in military custody with no lawyer present. He was not read his Miranda rights. He was held for 3 years, then finally charged in federal court with providing himself to al-Qaeda for training, as the U.S. attorney put it, to murder, kidnap, and maim. He was found guilty today with two other co-defendants. Mother Jones co-editor Clara Jeffrey has followed the case from the beginning, and welcome to our program.
Thanks very much for having me, Warren.
This became, according to the Associated Press of today's story, a symbol of the Bush administration's zeal to stop homegrown terror.
Well, in my opinion, this case has been a sort of travesty from beginning to end. I mean, as you said, he was originally arrested at O'Hare Airport and charged, and not for a month, actually, were we told that he was charged with being a quote, dirty bomber. And that announcement that Attorney General John Ashcroft made sort of right as the 9/11 Commission was taking the administration to task. So there's some interesting questions about the timing of when that announcement was made. You know, then they threw Mr. Padilla in a military brig for 3.5 years. He didn't have any access to attorneys or any outside information or help of any kind. And finally, when the Supreme Court was about to take up the case of whether or not that was legal, the administration transferred him to a civilian court and attached his name to this material support case of these two other defendants. And that's what he was finally charged on, basically, material support for groups that were, in the government's eyes, were terrorist organizations, and the defendants claimed were sort of charitable groups helping various Muslim groups overseas.
The key piece of physical evidence involved was a form that Padilla apparently filled out in July 2000 to attend an al-Qaeda trading camp. It had its fingerprints on it. There were other personal identifiers involved as well. Does that suggest that he was, in fact, guilty of the crimes he ultimately was charged with?
Well, I mean, I think the problem with this whole case is I don't think we'll ever really know. I mean, yes, they presented this form that they said has had his fingerprints on it, that a CIA agent in disguise testified at the trial that he had found this. You know, Padilla's attorneys were expected to make the case that, you know, he was asked to handle it at another time. And even if his fingerprints were on it, I mean, that sort of is a long way yet from proving that he actually took action against the United States or, you know, in what context was this form filled out, you know, where did it go? I mean, all of that is sort of obscure.
There were also 300,000 FBI wiretap intercepts introduced, as I understand it, or at least that they were used for the investigation, claiming that Padilla and the others were, and other people as well, were in fact talking about violent attacks on various places. Did you find that persuasive at all?
Well, I mean, again, I mean, the problem with this is, yes, they had 300,000 taped conversations. Padilla's voice is only heard on 7 of these 300,000 taped conversations. I mean, he definitely knew one of the other defendants, and you know, they had some sort of affiliation. You know, it's not the government's case about those conversations is that words like zucchini and football and so forth actually meant things like bomb and al-Qaeda. I mean, you know, maybe they could persuade jurors that was the case, but I think the fact that Padilla's voice is only heard on 7 of those 300,000 conversations, you know, if he is, as the government put it, a star recruit, why wasn't he part of, you know, a greater part of those conversations?
Again.
You know, again, I'm not saying that he, you know, he may have been up to no good. The problem is that because the government's case keeps relying on things that were found under coercion, that the attorneys, and in this case, were not allowed to tell jurors that Padilla was originally charged with being a dirty bomber, nor that he was held for 3.5 years without access to an attorney. And in fact, you know, they dismissed a number of the jurors in their voir dire process because jurors did know too much about it, too much about the case, doubted the government's case, doubted the government on various other things to do with the war, and so, you know, as the prosecution is apt to do, I mean, they found a very select jury.
But you're allowed to do that. The defense can do that too, can't it?
Yep, you sure can. And I mean, that's part of our process. But in this case, I mean, the fact that so many of the most basic parts of how this man came to be in custody was never put before the jury, and just the long record of the administration's handling of this case, you know, it's a verdict without much satisfaction, because I think that we're never going to really know how much a part of this he was, if at all, and you know, and it doesn't give any great relief to certainly people that care about civil liberties.
Presumably, he or people on his behalf can appeal the verdict, can they not?
Well, I'm not a lawyer. I mean, they need grounds for appeal other than just this isn't true. You know, they might be able to carve out various other jurisdictional issues, and maybe there's some problems with the trial itself. But, you know, I'm sure that they will file some kind of appeal, and we're not going to hear the end of this case. And there's also, of course, the sentencing hearing.
Set for December 5th, I believe. Are you surprised it only took the jury 1.5 days to come to these guilty verdict?
You know, as soon as I heard that they weren't being told that he was the dirty bomber, but the government had dropped those charges, that you know, the government talked very little about Padilla until the end of the trial where they sort of said, oh, and, you know, he's one of the star recruits of these other two guys, and that the jury also didn't know that he was held without access for an attorney to an attorney for 3.5 years, I wasn't surprised. I think that this, you know, the government has been kind of scaring us all along, and some of these threats are real. Others are sort of ginned up. I mean, Padilla, in many people's opinion, is a sort of, you know, at best an Al-Qaeda wannabe who kind of got caught up with some people and may have been up to no good, but whether or not he was, you know, certainly the government didn't even try and make the case that he was a dirty bomber. What exactly he was doing over there, at the Kara camp, if in fact he ever went, is still unknown.
So never presented evidence that he actually went to a training camp, just that he had applied to do it.
Right. As I understand it, I mean, they don't really have any evidence. And even, you know, there's this it's called a Mujahideen application form. I'm not quite sure what that means, if that actually says I commit to going to this camp or just I want to be kind of a part of this movement, which, you know, of course, when that was filled out, there's so many questions about that form itself in my mind.
All right. The jury verdict is in. Obviously, the controversy continues. And Clara Jeffrey, thanks a lot for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Co-editor Mother Jones Magazine, former senior editor at Harper's Magazine. Today's program produced by Vanessa Romo with Christian Bordahl and Dan Konecki. Our technical director is Mike Newport. For more information about To The Point or to email us, visit kcrw.com/To The Point. I'm Armin Alney. Join us again for To The Point, produced live and podcast as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.